It's June 7th. Holy smokes. Committee on Rules. I'm going to go ahead and take House Bill 2077 first, understanding that there is some controversy regarding that bill.
Controversy?
A little controversy, which is good, on a Tuesday morning. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2077. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Senator Morris, come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2077 requires the Department of Transportation to adjust public improvement contracts under certain circumstances, and this would be at the contractor's request, if the delivery price of steel material is more than 2% above the price of the material on the original bid or quote.
Thank you. Senator Morris, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. I'd like to speak to the bill and probably share with you the eyes of a contractor, because that's been my background. And the question is this bill in the public's interest? And my comments would focus on the element of risk in contracting. High risk equals high prices. And when you're dealing with commodities such as steel and asphalt, which we already do have a provision for protecting the volatility of asphalt, when you're dealing with high volatility in commodities, the only response that a bidder can make is, number one, go to the supplier and ask the supplier to protect you when you bid the contract at a fixed price. And if that doesn't occur, then the only alternative that you're left with is to add a contingency for the volatility. And that's a guessing game. And whenever you're in that guessing game, you wind up adding for what you think the market will do in terms of pricing for that product. So two things can happen. One is the price can go up much greater than what you bid, and if it's a project that is heavily weighted to the commodity that you're, for example, asphalt in an overlay project, you can have a contractor that can suffer substantially and sustain a loss. No contractor can continue to provide services at losses. So you wind up actually the owner of a project. When you have a contractor that's failing, that is not a good equation, because quality suffers, timeline suffers, delivery of the product and quality suffers. So my encouragement is that we adopt this bill as a matter of public policy, because I think it's in the public's interest, not just the contractor's interest, but the public's interest, to protect against overly high pricing because of the volatility in commodities, particularly in this case, specifically steel. So I believe this is a good bill. I think it's in the public's interest, and would encourage you to adopt House Bill 2077 as amended.
Thank you. Senator Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. Here with me today is Larry Gesher with Sladen Construction, who is a contractor that is dealt on the ground and worked with ODOT on this issue. I'll let Mr. Gesher go ahead and explain the bill from his perspective, and then provide some follow-up comments on some of the issues that you'll hear this morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and committee. I'll try to give you a little bit of background on what kind of went on with this whole steel escalation starting back in late 2003. For the record, my name is Larry Gesher with Sladen Construction in Staten, Oregon. I am here today on behalf of my fellow members of the Associated General Contractors and to urge you to support House Bill 2077A. Founded in 1984, Sladen Construction is an Oregon-grown construction business that works up and down the West Coast. Our business is diverse, from schools to fish ladders to wastewater treatment plants to fish greens to bridges. I am the manager for the bridge division at Sladen Construction. Today I'm here to share with you about the steel crisis that paralyzed all of Oregon's highway construction industry and why House Bill 2077 is so important to help in helping to repair the damage the crisis has caused. In the waning months of 2003 and in 2004, the price of steel in the state and worldwide began to rise at an uncontrollable and unanticipated rate. The rise in prices were so volatile that suppliers were not able to honor their bid quotes they had previously given to customers, and additional surcharges were applied at the time of delivery. The cause of the crisis can be contributed to many sources. China and other developing countries began to buy scrap steel at very aggressive rates, which caused the price of scrap steel to increase sharply. Estimates indicate that at one point, China was consuming one-third of the world's scrap steel supply. The prices of coke, a material used in the production of steel, rose sharply when a devastating fire ravaged a West Virginia coal mine and caused a severe shortage. Steel producers in the United States were beginning to consolidate, and fourth, world events that drove up the demand for structural steel for military reasons. All of these events combined at one time and completely out of control of the industry resulted in a sharp increase in steel prices unlike any I've seen in my construction career. Contractors in Oregon tried to respond to the crisis by purchasing the steel they knew they would need as soon as the market began to fluctuate. However, in the Northwest, the mills put fabricators on allotments, making it impossible to purchase all of the steel. It simply was not available. Contractors were forced by circumstances driven by international events and unforeseen to anyone in the industry to absorb the price increases that were impossible to predict and far exceeded the amount bid into the contract. On June 24, 2003, I bid and was awarded a project for the Oregon Department of Transportation for the replacement of two I-84 bridges over the Grand Ronde River just west of LeGrand. The contract value for this project was $8.2 million with a completion date of September 30, 2006. The construction season was set by traffic and environmental restrictions for the period of May 1 through November 1 of each year during the contract. This meant that even though the contract was awarded on August 1st of 2003, the replacement of the first bridge would not occur for another year, and the second bridge would not start for 2 years. Because most of the steel fabricators work on a just-in-time delivery method, they have very little storage capacity. Therefore, when the steel prices started to spike in November of 2003, many fabricators and contractors were forced to pay the escalated prices, even though we had no idea the price was going to double. On this project alone, the cost of the reinforcement rose nearly $400,000. This is just one small example of the impact this unforeseen steel escalation has had on an Oregon construction business. AGC contractors have worked with ODOT for over a year now to try and respond to this crisis. We have been addressing this issue on two fronts. The first is to establish a steel escalation clause. The second is to provide relief on current and past contracts that were impacted by this event. Today, if you signed an ODOT contract, you would find an oil and fuel escalation de-escalation clause. This clause in the contract was developed by contractors and the department to protect all parties against the ebb and flow of oil prices, so that if the price goes up, the contractor gets compensated, and if the price goes down, the agency benefits. We are working on a similar escalation de-escalation clause for steel and believe we will be able to come to an agreement and that ODOT will implement such a clause soon. This will help on future contracts where we may experience this issue again. For current contracts, however, the situation is not as easily resolved. ODOT specifications do not allow for any relief to the contractor for extraordinary events such as these. ODOT and AGC contractor attorneys spent hours looking for a way to provide such relief under the current contracts. And the conclusion is that there is no legal way for ODOT to provide payment on these claims. House Bill 2077A provides ODOT with the ability to accept and pay these claims. Contractors, by our nature, accept risk. Every time we hard bid a contract, there is a chance that the prices of commodities may adjust. In this case, however, the prices didn't just adjust. They rose sharply, and even the experts in the steel industry were unable to predict how or when they might level off. This left contractors and suppliers in a real bind, and for small contractors in particular, the rising price of steel created a real hardship. One supplier, Graham Steel, closed their doors because of this crisis. He was unable to stand behind his bids and couldn't pass along the cost of his to his customers. When Graham Steel closed, a major supplier of rebar, which is in all concrete, disappeared from Oregon contractors. This bill will significantly help contractors, especially small contractors who found themselves caught by this crisis. We urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Shields.
When did the oil fuel escalation, de-escalation clause go into effect, and how has it worked over the years, or how long has it been around?
It's worked really well from my experience in the industry, and it came up back when we saw the sharp increase
back,
in the...
Way back in the 70s, yes, in the fuel crisis?
Yes, exactly right.
Well, there's a lot of history on it then, mm-hmm. as to how it worked.
As the three of you probably are aware, the cities and counties now have some concerns about the bill. I'd like one of you to stick around, respond to their concerns as soon as we can get them up here.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. The escalation, de-escalation clause, you're negotiating for that to be put into future contracts. But this bill essentially bails out people that are stuck in existing contracts. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, the contractors were surprised by the rapidly increasing steel costs. Have there been occasions where the contractors have benefited by reduction in costs? In the last decade.
We've never seen this type of spike or in either direction, up or down, as far as a commodity.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
But historically, I mean, it's my understanding that in the last couple of years, a number of factors have combined so that prices have gone through the roof. But before that, historically, have you seen wide fluctuations in the cost of steel, or has it been pretty steady,
really steady?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, this is a one-of-a-kind situation that the entire industry and, quite frankly, worldwide sent steel manufacturers and steel users hit them in a way that no one ever could have anticipated. For Oregon's highway industry, especially small contractors that are homegrown businesses that are preparing to work on OTA3, this is putting them in a position where it's very difficult for them to absorb these costs, and they can't, in a hard bid environment, pass those costs on. We're trying to assume a portion of the risk and ask our customers, the agencies, to assume a portion of that risk as well. We are, in this bill, like in the oil and fuel escalation clauses today, we take the first 10% risk on our own. We hold on to that. Any adjustment above that, any increase above that, is what the agencies, if a claim is filed, would then be held and would then help us out in providing some relief above that 10% threshold.
Madam Chair, are we going to hear from ODOT on this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Next up, Mr. John Jackley from ODOT. Good morning and welcome. How are you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Appreciate being here. For the record, my name is John Jackley with the Highway Division at the Department of Transportation. As you heard earlier, the price of steel, driven by China and other factors, more than doubled in late 2003 and 2004. As you heard earlier, we've worked cooperatively with the industry to address this problem on two fronts. The first is the development of a future contract specification that will allow for de-escalation and escalation considerations. By including both, that becomes acceptable to Federal Highway for reimbursement. The second piece is to work with them in the development of this bill. The bill does share the risk of steel price escalation between the contracting community and the department. Essentially, pursuant to the conditions of the bill, the contractors would assume or take the first 10% of those increases increases, the department would pick up the amount over 10%. This would apply to contracts signed on or after April 1st, 2003, to the point where we would put the new specifications into our contracts. We worked exhaustively with the Department of Justice and the contracting community to look for a legal way to do this kind of reimbursement without having to do a bill, and just couldn't get there on the legal front. So in order for us to be able to reimburse contractors for the dramatic spike in steel increases over this time period, we would need this kind of remedy in the bill to do those kind of payments. And I'd be glad to answer any questions you all might have.
Thank you. Questions? Chair Rango.
So what will the charge be to ODOT?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had to make some estimates. We don't have reliably hard figures, but our estimate is that it could be as much or exceed $5 million. The calculations were based roughly like this. For this period of time that we're looking at, we had approximately $868 million in contracts. We estimated that raw steel could be as much as $10 million of that figure, and with a 50% increase in steel, our estimate was approximately $5 million. But to be honest, it could be more, it could be less.
Thank you. Mr. Jackley, as I read the bill, and I know this is an extremely unlikely circumstance, but essentially, taxpayers are going to absorb the increase in steel prices should the costs go up. The bill does not provide, as I read it, for the event, in the event steel prices would go down. And I know it's retroactive, so it's sort of I'm trying to play hypothetically here, but basically, there's not sort of a give and a take. It's only a give under the circumstances. Is that correct as I read the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill addresses what we hope is essentially a fixed period of time, April 1st, 2003, to when we put the new specification in our contracts. During that period of time, Madam Chair, you're correct, it would be a give, and that's because steel prices spiked but did not have a corresponding drop.
And then my understanding is the cities and counties have concerns because ODOT essentially does some bidding for them. Have you had any conversations with those folks?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have had some conversations with them. The way it works essentially is for what we call federal aid projects. ODOT enters into contracts with local jurisdictions where we provide federal dollars to them for projects, and they build the projects essentially with us. Those contracts typically have a couple of provisions. The first is that there's some kind of local match, and then the second is that what's technically called non-participatory costs, i.e. costs that Federal Highway will not reimburse us for, the local jurisdictions pick those up. In the event or under this bill, steel escalation would be a non-participatory cost. And so that's been the basis of the concerns that we've heard so far.
Okay, thanks. So, Ringo?
The bill starts at a specific time, April 1st, 2003. It would seem to me it would go through a set period of time, such as June 1st, 2005. Any contractor entering contracts at this point knows the volatility of steel. Why can't you implement the escalation de-escalation clause right now as of any future contracts? And I understand you're working on it, but I don't understand why it's that difficult.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, the context of this is that we did work exhaustively with the Department of Justice to try and figure out a way to do this absent a bill, and just couldn't get there with the attorneys.
I'm talking about future contracts.
My understanding is that we're going to have these new contract specs finished in the next month or so, certainly by August, and that provides that kind of fixed date that I think we're all looking for.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo, I understand exactly your point. What we're talking about is passing a bill that only that I think the intent was to apply to contracts already signed, but there's no time limitation in the parameters of the bill, so essentially this would apply to all contracts in the future. And I don't know if that was the intent, but that's how we read this.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, it would apply until we get the contract spec finished and put into all of our contracts, which, again, we anticipate getting done by August.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just...
Senator Ringo.
You know, I've got this AGC flyer that has the chart showing steel prices going up. And according to this chart, it spiked in about, I think, December of 2004, and then it actually went down by... Oh, I don't know, $40 a ton, I think, is what we're talking about. I mean, why doesn't the... It's at least in this chart, there is the possibility of steel prices actually decreasing. I understand that the argument about this bill is that they've only increased, but if you look at this chart, there is the possibility that they've decreased.
Come on out. Adamson, come on out.
It says steel scrap, so that might not mean all steel.
Right.
Well, I would expect that to be the pertinent figure.
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, there was, according to that chart, there was a slight dip, but it didn't affect the price of what the finished product was. Those prices started to hold steady, and again, to the extent that we're looking at these contracts, the prices have only gone up. We have not seen prices on the market go down at all. The bill in Section 2, Sub 4, to answer another concern, in Section 2, Sub 4, this is on lines 2 through 5 on the page 2, the bill, though it doesn't provide a stop date, does say that it won't apply once the contracts themselves include a price escalation, and in that's Legislative Council's wording, as the industry understands, as ODOT understands, that is the de-escalation clause. So, again, like oil and fuel, this will provide for the benefit to the agency if prices go back down, and if prices go back up, again, that risk share on the part of the contractor, and then compensation above the 10% risk.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to bring up John, and I'm sorry I can't read your last name, Tiffany and Susan Schneider.
Once the de-escalation of the escalation considerations put into the task force. I think the escalation...
Good morning.
Good morning. John O'Shell. Someone else wrote my name. Sorry, I tend to print it myself.
I don't know that I would have gotten it right anyway, so you're off the hook.
County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Basically, there's about three issues floating here, and we frankly only have concern with the third one, but maybe do a little bit of talking to understand where our concerns are. The issue of having the inflationary factor for steel, we fully support having that in there. It will result in better bids because it shares the risks appropriately, as it's been done with fuel. It should be done for steel. Candidly, based on what I've been reading on the markets, it probably should be done with cement. Because we're hearing that that is likely to spike sometime in the near future also. So frankly, if we're solving problems, we probably should be looking at cement also. The second issue is what should we do about the poor contractors who frankly bid multi-year contracts and then had this thing spike on them unanticipated? Certain sympathy for that. Frankly, if it's a case of, speaking for at least my agencies, picking up our share of that, don't really have a concern with that. When you're looking at it, and basically probably looking at a statewide basis for you to make a policy call, whatever you go in that general direction we would support, would comment what you're really trying to find is the contractors who actually bid it before they had a realization that it was likely to spike. Once a contractor had a realization that it was likely to spike and he didn't have an inflationary in there, he probably put something in there to deal with that potential for an inflationary increase. So it may or may not be in his bid. How to sort that one out, I'm not sure. But there certainly were a bunch of contractors who got caught off guard with this. we're sympathetic to that. However you come up with that, good luck. The third issue that is really important to us, though, is the way this bill is written up for federal aid projects. It is a very heavy hit on some of our small local governments. Let me clarify a little bit on what John Jackley said. The way federal aid projects work, and the first thing you have to realize about federal aid projects, local government never sees a federal dollar. Federal aid projects are constructed with ODOT money. ODOT then gets reimbursed by the feds for their costs. The state then has an agreement with the counties where we, in advance, pay our match money on this. So, in effect, if they build a project that's $1 million at a 20% match, ahead of the project, the local government will pay the $200,000, the 20%. After it's constructed, then the feds will pay the 80%. It's fine. It works well. I mean, it's a system that's been out there for decades and decades and decades. The problem is what we refer to as non-participatory. And what it is, if there's something that is not covered, then basically the feds pay short. They don't pay for it. The local government picks up the difference. To hit you with how that potentially could work, if you've got a project that's, once again, that $1 million project, and if for some reason there's 5% for some reason that's not covered, then get my arithmetic right there. Basically, that's, don't got the right number of zeros. 50,000, excuse me. So 50,000 is there. What happens is the local government, instead of paying the $200,000, now pays $250,000. Where there was a 5% increase in the project, the local government share went up 25%. Now, if you're talking a small agency, and we have agencies that the federal aid projects approach the size of their annual government, that amount of a jump, unexpected, is a nasty hit that is tough for them to make. Typically, a smaller government, when you get a federal aid project, you start saving your match for 2 or 3 years. I mean, it takes you a couple years to get that $200,000 saved up. And if all of a sudden, at the end of the project, it's a surprise, you got to come up with another $50,000, big number for them, hard for them to deal with that risk. So this way this bill is set up, the risk for them is quite high. It's not a minimal number that's picked up as part of the whole project. And that's the problem we need to try and figure out a way to solve.
And this issue was not raised in the House, correct?
My understanding is this bill in the House was a totally different bill. This is a gut.
Well, it was substantially amended, so.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to turn it over to Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned that we should try to figure this out. If you got about 15 minutes, you can.
I'm willing to put some time into this. There's a problem here that needs solved.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Schneider of the City of Portland Government Relations. I think that John has pretty well explained to you what the problem is. Our understanding was, and the reason we weren't involved, I don't think, in any of the conversations that took place between ODOT and HEC in the House, is this was never intended to affect local governments, large or small. And so we think, while we're opposed to the bill as it stands, that there is a solution, and that would be to have an amendment that just takes those projects out of the bill, and we're happy to work with proponents to do that. I think John's really described the problem, and it hits us, a large agency as well. We have at least two projects that fall in this category. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Question, really, hold on.
What do you mean when you say take those projects out of the bill? I mean, what's the financial impact of that? Do the contractors then not get an escalation? Is that what you mean? Or explain.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the issue is not the escalation clause. I think that Mr. Oshel has described a feeling we all share, that that's an appropriate thing to go forward with. It's the look-back provision, and when the project, this goes back to 2003, when the look-back goes that far, I mean, you don't have the money, you don't have the money. That's the issue. You've already done the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and again, I concur with my two colleagues here. The real issue for our membership is this liability for small rural communities when they have a significant federal project and the
federal agency is not willing to take up that share in terms of non-participatory costs. That puts a huge burden, 100% of that liability on the local government. And we're talking about small rural communities where 10, 20, 30,000 could be their entire transportation maintenance fund for the entire year. So those costs could be very significant. We do agree that, I do want to put on the record, we apologize. We were unable to receive the impacts of this bill till late yesterday, and I do want to put on the record, apologize to AGC. They've been good to try to work with, and if we had this information earlier, maybe we could have been a little more prepared with a solution today, although we do agree that an exemption for those local projects would be appropriate in this case. We'd be happy to move forward with that or any other solution to try to get this worked out in a very expedited manner if the proponents are willing to do so. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Senator Atkinson.
Who gets the benefit from these projects?
The public.
Where? All in Salem? Are they all in Washington, D.C.? I mean, who actually benefits from building a road or a bypass or a bridge?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know quite how to answer you. I assume.
Well, is this?
We all do.
Well, actually, it's a real small. It's the communities out there. It just seems kind of crazy to me that we're talking about federal match, we're talking about bringing in state, we're talking about fixing problems out there, and then all of a sudden this thing comes up where we're talking about a $50,000 silt fence or something like that. I mean, who knows what it is. But the objections here seem a little goofy, all due respect. Don't really seem kind of minor in comparison to who gets the benefit. All these projects, federal projects, aren't being built in some other state, being built in our state. Am I missing something here? Have I had too much coffee? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, I think the point is that the public benefits from these projects, but also where the matching funds come for these projects is Oregon taxpayers, and those are a zero-sum gain. So when those funds are required to pay 100% of the overrun, those are Oregon public infrastructure projects that are not done. In terms of paying for those overruns. So there is no golden pot of money in local government where these funds just come from. They are transportation-related dollars that are slated for projects, and if they have to be used to retro an existing project, then they can't be used for their slated project on the books today.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Ringo.
Well, more of a comment. You know, I asked the question, how much will this cost? And the ODOT testimony was they're not sure, maybe around $5 million. If ODOT, and this is just my perspective on this, if ODOT has that money available, I guess that's then fine. ODOT does. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that because I have a feeling that if prices went the other way, the contractors would say, great, we get a windfall, but because prices went up, ODOT's going to pay more money for that. But if ODOT thinks it has the money to do that, okay, that's ODOT's money. But if the communities aren't able or aren't willing to pay the money, then that's where I would not want them to have to bear that cost. And so I would just ask you and what you work out to. It's important to me who's going to end up paying this, whether it's LeGrand or Beaverton or John Day. I would not want them to bear these costs. If it comes out of some ODOT slush fund, then that's up to ODOT.
We heard testimony earlier that escalator de-escalator clauses work. So I'm assuming that this really is a two-way relationship between contractors and project managers, whether they're municipalities or counties. Is there any way to engage the feds? Obviously, this problem is national. In every single city or community nationwide, we've got an escalating steel cost, and they're dealing with these escalator de-escalator clauses. How have other people handled it? And what is there? It seems that the feds want to have a certainty when nobody else has certainty. So is there any way to engage them?
Chair Farioli, members of the committee, I did a rapid set of phone calls with FHWA yesterday. I was talking with their bridge engineer. There is a memo floating around within the federal eight offices that I haven't got a hold of a copy yet, but I got an email that explained it. The issue that the feds have is they've got laws on their books that say you don't go back and retroactively change conditions in contracts. And they've approved a project as a certain date and with certain conditions, and they're saying, no, you can't go back. So there's a memo floating out there, basically nationwide, that says they're not going to support making payments for these type of inflationary ones that are done retroactively. They're okay with the ones going forward, but not the ones going backwards. So the local federal officers are looking at that memo and saying they don't have authority. So apparently nationwide, as the steel crisis hit, the feds have made the decision no.
I'm sure if I may continue.
Sure, Senator Farrell.
Sounds like a great opportunity. We're into daily doubles if you've looked at the schedule for bills. This looks like a great opportunity for the League of Oregon Cities and the Associated Oregon Counties to meet with AGC and figure out which provisions you need to have move forward and which provisions will not move forward in terms of the look back or exemptions to projects and come back with a solution.
Thank you. I also assume, I don't know if somebody asked this question, but have you had any conversations with the House chair or the House leadership about if we take care of you all, is the bill going to go to conference committee or is it going to be passed? Has anybody had that conversation? No. Okay. All right. You guys have 48 hours. Let's see what you can come up with. That we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2077. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3206. Ms. Harris, what do we have?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 3206 prohibits state or local public contracting agencies from awarding public works contracts or personal service contracts to non-resident bidders that are education service districts.
Okay. Thanks, Brittany. I'm like, don't run over Rita. Let's see. Matt Lindsay and Jessica Amundson and Jerry Milstead. Why don't you all come on up? Did I miss anyone? It was Tim. I'm sorry.
I have along with me Tim Romano and Doug Nichols.
Okay, all right. Ms. Adamson, I'm going to have you sit right here for a minute. Come on up, you guys. I assumed that was the law firm you were with, so I was like, okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Senator Brown, members of the committee. My name is Matt Lisney, and I'm an attorney with Preston Gates and Ellis in Portland, Oregon. My address, residential, is 7007 North Columbia Way, Portland, Oregon, 97203. I'm here representing Educational Service District 112, which is located at 2500 Northeast 65th Avenue, Vancouver, Washington. And we're here to present our opposition to House Bill 3206, which, as it presently reads, would eliminate and prohibit any out-of-state educational service district from bidding on certain construction contracts for the development of school facilities. The educational services are, just to tell you a little bit about what they do, we provide a variety of educational services for local school districts throughout Southwest Washington and other areas in Washington and Oregon. The ESD offers over 285 programs in education-related areas, which include special education assistance, staff development for teachers, prevention of substance abuse by youth, as well as assistance with construction management services, which is what House Bill 3206 concerns. With respect to the construction of school facilities, we'd like to clarify the services that the Educational Service District does provide. The Educational Service District assists schools with construction management, constructability reviews, and building commissioning. The Educational Service District does not construct school facilities or serve as a construction contractor in any way for any of the construction projects that it assists with. It does not pound nails or lay bricks. And instead, the Educational Service District provides services as an on-site owner's representative representing the school district's interests. And our goal in providing these services is to ensure that new and modernized school facilities are built in accordance with the needs of the school district. In doing so, we monitor a project schedule, budget, and quality on behalf of the school district and serve as the district's representative with the design team and construction contractor during all phases of construction. We often provide this service to small and rural local school districts that don't have the funding or the staff to provide that service on their own. Typical tasks would that would include weekly project meetings with construction contractors, the design team, and the architects to identify problems and problem areas in construction to ensure that the projects are completed on time according to the cost schedules and to ensure that there's quality in the construction and the final construction of the buildings. And the Educational Service District has developed specialized expertise through over 12 years of experience in managing school construction projects for local school districts. Few other ESDs, if any, can provide this unique service, and it's not uncommon for ESD 112 to be requested for assistance directly from local ESDs for the construction of local school projects. And many school districts are also attracted to doing business with the Educational Service District just because that they do share the common goal of providing the best learning environment possible for students. And we object, we present our objection to House Bill 3206 because as it presently reads, it flat out prohibits the Educational Service District from offering school districts an additional choice when selecting construction managers. The Educational Service District believes that increasing choices and increasing competition will better serve Oregon school districts and Oregon taxpayers. It helps to ensure the best quality of construction at the lowest possible price. The Educational Service District provides specialized technical knowledge and background and experience in many areas of school construction. Unlike other construction management entities, the Educational Service District only manages school projects and does not involve or work with commercial, industrial, housing development projects. Because of this, the Educational Service District is extremely efficient in construction management process for schools and can provide school districts with a proficient, cost-effective set of services. The Educational Service District believes that the best solution for effective construction of public buildings, and particularly schools, is through encouraging competition between bidders on the basis of experience, quality, and price. Thank you for your time today, Senator Brown, members of the committee. We respectfully request that the Rules Committee not take action on House Bill 3206.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify? Okay. Questions for this panel? Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, I just want to understand this. So you're, what's your name again?
It's Matt Lisney.
Okay, you're from Preston Gates.
Preston Gates and Ellis, yeah.
Okay, and you folks are?
My name is Doug Nichols, and I'm the director of the Construction Management Program for Educational Service District 112.
Okay.
And Tim Merlino, I'm the Chief Financial Officer at ESD 112.
Okay. I assume you're not here because you're concerned about Oregon's taxpayers or even about Oregon's school children. I think it's because you want your ESD to do business in our state. Is that accurate?
Doug Nichols, I think that certainly is part of the answer, Senator Ringo. The I think the situation that we find ourselves in is that we offer a fairly unique service in providing construction management through an educational service district. And it's not unusual for us to get requests from school districts outside of our region to help from time to time. It's not a lot of projects, quite frankly. Over the last 12 years, we've probably only done roughly 12 projects. So in answer to your question, I think we would like to keep the opportunity open to assist districts that ask for our assistance.
Madam Chair, ESDs sometimes claim to be entrepreneurial. They carry out activities to make money for the ESDs. Is this an example of that? When you would come into Oregon and provide these services, do you make money out of that?
We certainly get paid a fee for our services, yes.
But it's a fee, you make a profit essentially. It's a fee that exceeds your expenses.
If it exceeds it, it exceeds it only modestly. It's not a for-profit operation. We are a non-profit entity. We do not accrue profits.
Well, Madam Chair, I know you're a non-profit entity in one sense, but on the other hand, ESDs, they use the word entrepreneurial in a sense that they carry out activities for the express purpose of making money for the ESDs, and they can use that money to pay for other services.
Sure. And that's not the way it works in Washington. In Washington, entrepreneurial means entrepreneurial because we have a $47 million budget, and we get our allocation from the state is $400,000 to operate. The rest of that $47 million is made up of 285 cooperative fee-for-service or federal and state competitive grant awards. And if those programs, all the other 285 programs we have, are self-supported. meaning they have to pay their share of their space, they have to pay their network charges, all the charges that go that and other administrative costs to the ESD to support the ESD administration. So if those programs don't cover their costs, they either have to make cuts or the program goes away. We're different than Oregon ESD.
That's very clear.
Okay.
Can I get the numbers again? You said 47 million, and then I didn't get the next number.
Our allocation from the state is $400,000.
Okay. And your budget is 47 million?
In Oregon.
Okay.
Let's ask. Madam Chair, who else are we going to hear from on this bill?
I hope the proponents.
Okay. Well, for one thing, Augie Rose is sitting back there. I'm wondering if he's on this list.
He's not. Okay. But he may want to avoid this issue while we've got these folks here from Washington.
I think I fully answered your question.
Okay.
No, you asked about the construction management itself. In a given year, probably we'll have a little over $1 million worth of work, maybe $1.2 million worth of work between the construction managers that we have in the school districts. Maybe there's a profit of $20,000, something like that.
Do those dollars then go to support your other programs?
They stay in the program.
Okay.
Because there are times when we end up with the boom-bust cycle of no bonds being passed, and we may want to carry one of our managers on a couple of months to make sure we don't have any work for them. So that's what we use the money for.
And for let me finish.
Yes.
For the uninformed about Washington ESDs, could you tell us a little bit about the services that you provide?
Sure. We have, like I said, 285 programs. And we provide special ed cooperative for, meaning that we run the special ed program for 19 of our 30 districts in our region.
You provide all the special ed services?
We hire the teachers, all the aides, run and collect all the revenue from those school districts and run the program for them.
Okay. What else?
Which is pretty unique. I mean, our ESD is the only one in the state that does that.
Okay.
We operate 25 child care centers in Southwest Washington in school districts.
Is that for after school programs, preschool programs?
Preschool, before and after, but it's whatever the community wants. It could be toddlers, infants, whatever the school district asks for, we'll do it. And it's fee paying parents.
Okay.
Substance abuse programs, and that's a variety of state federal grants. We run insurance pools. We self-insure for work comp, unemployment, property casualty. Our construction management program, we have hire business managers for school districts and network support people for school districts, and they'll contract with us for those individuals. We have a statewide software for student records and fiscal management, and we support those school districts in our area for those items. I'm trying to think.
That gives us a pretty good feel of the activities you're involved with. Senator Ringo, did you have any further questions?
I was just going to point out they have 9 ESDs in the state of Washington compared to our 20.
Thank you. How many school districts do you have in Washington?
296.
Okay. All right. Do you have anything further, Senator Ringo? Can we get your name again? I'm sorry, for the record.
Tim Merlino, Merlino.
Madam Chair, I was just going to make a comment that they hire the excellent lawyers at Preston Gates and Ellis to represent them. And it must be because they really, really want to do business in Oregon. They say they don't make that much money doing business in Oregon, but if it's not for the money, it's because they really do care about our taxpayers and our school children, and I'm glad to hear that they do. So,
thank you very much for joining us today. Okay, Ms. Adamson, Mr. Milstead, come on up.
Mm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson, representing the Associated General Contractors. We're here today in support of House Bill 3206, which we believe to be a very simple bill that's very narrow, dealing with out-of-state education service districts and construction only. This doesn't limit the cooperation of ESDs on other services, but it does relate to construction. We do have a whole group of folks in Oregon that do construction management and owner's representative services, and I have one of those folks here today with me, Jerry Milstead with Milstead and Associates, that has extensive experience in representing school districts on these kind of projects as the owner's representative and construction manager. These folks are Oregon-based businesses that are Oregon taxpayers and put their taxpayer dollars back into Oregon's economy, employ Oregonians who, again, benefit the local school district. We believe that it is a public policy call, but we believe that it is appropriate public policy to have Oregon taxpayer dollars return to Oregon businesses or other Oregon public entities to work on these projects, that it isn't necessarily the best public policy to have these dollars go out of state to other public agencies. We believe that there is more than enough firms in Oregon that can competitively provide these kinds of services on behalf of school districts, and I'll let Mr. Milstead talk more about who those firms are and how that process works.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, Senators, I'm Jerry Milstead, and I'm President of Milstead & Associates. I have 40 years' experience in the construction industry primarily as an owner's representative, both in the private sector and public sector. In the last few years, I think in 1999, 2000, there was about $800 million worth of bonds, school bonds passed in the state. Our firm represented 9 school districts and managed their bond program. We do provide the services that the attorney for Preston Gates laid out, so I won't bore you with that list of items again. But we do represent these school districts. I have more competition than probably I would like, but there is competition. There's Vickers. Nelson, who also manage programs in Oregon. They're an Oregon firm. They manage construction programs for school districts. Shields and Oblitz has been around for many, many years in Portland. They also manage construction programs and are competitors of ours. And Cornerstone Construction Management is another firm that pretty well is exclusive to school districts. One thing about certainly I'm not a nonprofit organization, or at least that's certainly not the plan. We do make money. However, and if you don't make money, you lose money, and it doesn't matter whether you're a nonprofit or a profit. If you make money in Oregon and you're a Washington firm, the money goes to Washington. If you don't make money in Oregon, the money from Washington has to come to support you for Oregon. So this is the biggest problem that we have with a public agency from another state coming in to our state and unfairly competing with the private industry in this state that does the same thing. And as far as caring about school kids, I don't know of anybody that could care more about them than my firm. We support the Gresham. We worked for 16 years with the Gresham School District, and we support all of their programs that they have which is one is a golf tournament every year. We support that and have for many years. We support the Sherwood School District with their programs. We also do a lot of work with these school districts where we don't send them bills. Portland Schools for one, Gresham Schools for another, and Sherwood Schools. Those are 3 school districts we're working with right now, and we do quite a bit of work without sending them bills. So we do care about the kids and about what they get. But because of our experience, we can also provide this constructability review and make sure that the schools get good buildings at a good price. So we are in support of the bill.
Thank you. Yes, I think there are a number of questions. Okay. Senator Farrielli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have recent experience with an ESD that has given entrepreneurialism
yes.
a little tarnish.
Yes.
But the question that strikes me, at least, is the different sectors that we see represented here. It sounds to me that you are in the private sector,
yes.
utterly and completely. So you're not affiliated with an ESD or any other public entity.
No, sir.
And can you talk just a little bit about whether or not you are on a level playing field when it comes to competing with the ESD from Washington?
Well, my Senator, Madam Chairman, Senator, my contention has been ever since we were aware that ESD 112 and the ESD that you were speaking of, the other ESD, that public agencies are supported by public taxpayer money. There's a cost to pursue projects. In other words, if a school district is going to build a school and they want a project manager, they put out a request for proposal, and it costs you money to respond to that request for proposal, whether you get that or not. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're a private agency or a public agency. It costs money to do it. Well, somebody has to, and if you don't get it, then you have to absorb that. You have to absorb that cost. Public agencies absorb that cost because they are supported by the public. As I said before, if they make money in Oregon, then it goes to support Washington. If they don't make money in Oregon, then Washington taxpayers have to support them here. There's a cost. You either make money or you lose money, and it doesn't matter whether you're a profit or non-profit concern. And I think no, to answer your question. Now, the short answer is no. We are not on a level playing field for that reason.
Any other questions? I guess for Ms. Adamson, is there equivalent situation of public entities from Oregon bidding on public works projects in Washington?
Chair Brown, no.
Okay. All right. Senator Ringo, any questions? Senator Shields? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3206, unless there's someone else in the audience wishing to testify. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2669. Ms. Harris, tell us about the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2937 would require the State Department of Transportation to suspend for 6 months the driving privileges of any person convicted of stealing gasoline.
Okay, I grabbed the wrong bill file. Okay, Mr. Romaine, come on up.
Thanks. Chair, I suggested you open a public hearing on 2937 first because...
That's what you, okay.
No,
right, okay.
Correct.
All right, okay. I'll open a public hearing on 2937, which Ms. Harris just explained.
Thank you very much. Makes my testimony more okay. relevant, actually. I'd be happy to stay up for 2660.
Yes, apparently. It's okay, I was just going down the list, so...
He's flexible.
And I missed a bill, so let's do 2937 first.
You were fine. She messed things up. You were fine.
No, I didn't do it in order, which is what my intent was. So she was new. She knew what my intent was, Mr. Romaine.
I'm not taking sides in the controversy whatsoever. I just want to make sure I'm testifying on the right bill.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association. House Bill 2937. Deals with the theft of gasoline. Basically, it's increasing as prices go up. People tend to get lead foots. I'll try English next time. And hit the accelerator as the nozzle is being removed. What we want to do, theft of gasoline currently is a crime. What this does is suspend the driving privileges of anybody convicted of that crime. The reason for it is very simple. It's it's another threat that you can put out there, a warning to people. And frankly, what I have passed out to you are a couple of states, actually a list of states that have this legislation, but a couple of examples of things that are put on the pumps basically you have a mean-looking police officer standing there going, you could lose your license. The odds of somebody really being prosecuted for theft of $40 or $50 is probably between slim and none. But what we're trying to do is put some kind of provision out there that says, wait a second, you know, think twice before you do this. People are more concerned about their license. The only thing that has been raised is potential objection is driving. We've been using the driver's license as a way to sanction people, but actually this is unique. This is actually related to the driving privilege. It's gasoline. It goes in the car. You need that to actually drive the car. So it is related to the bill. So it passed with very few dissenting votes. I did not even lobby it on the floor of the House. It passed unanimously out of the House committee. I would ask your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Romain, a couple quick questions. I've actually never seen this happen at a pump, but maybe it's just the pumps I go to. But I'm curious, this happened 1% of the time, 5% of the time, 10% of the time?
Madam Chair, it happens very few times. It is not a huge problem out there. But it is a, what we're finding anecdotally, a growing problem. And we're just trying to figure out a way to cut it off.
Okay. Romain, the other question I have is that when folks lose their licenses for DUI, there's usually provision to allow people to get some type of provisional license so that they can go to work. I would hate to prohibit people from working if they're stealing gasoline in order to pay for their fuel. Any comments on that?
Madam Chair, this is put into the provision dealing with current driver's license suspension, and I believe all the provisions regarding work-related and things like that would apply.
Okay, and one more question. Does this apply to people who steal gas from other cars?
Madam Chair, yes, it would.
Okay.
Basically, the old, as some of us who are really old remember getting sick on actually swallowing as we were siphoning the gas. Yes, it would apply.
All right, questions for Mr. Romain. Senator Shields.
Just quickly, from my understanding, and maybe the committee's, say you have somebody that borrows your car, steals your car, whatever. When you zip out of the parking lot or the gas station, it's easy for the person to see the driver's lights or the license plate. Maybe they didn't get a good look at the driver of the car. That's not inconceivable. How do you make sure you're getting the person that's driving and not the owner of the car for the crime?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that's a good question, but remember, this does not trigger until you're actually convicted of theft. Mm-hmm. So you would have to actually go through the criminal hearing, basically, be arrested, convicted in court, and then it would trigger this. You still have to be convicted of the crime, and frankly, if they can't identify you, they're not going to be able to convict you.
Thank you.
Any questions? All right.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I just want to clarify whether the suspension is mandatory or whether it's discretionary. The language of the bill says a suspension under this subsection shall continue for a period of 6 months.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe it is, under the way it's written, mandatory. Again, I would emphasize that we believe the odds of this ever being implemented are very, very slim. It's something that has been used in other states as a threat, although I do understand a concern about mandatory versus discretionary.
And Mr. Romain, I'm assuming this is a preventative tool.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I'll probably support the bill. I thought from earlier discussion it was discretionary and mandatory minimums smack of Measure 11 issues, and I know this is a little bit different, but I hate the idea of removing judicial discretion as we've done in our state. Just a comment.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, again, with all the different provisions in there about you can get a temporary or a license to go to work, yeah, and all those other things, mandatory really becomes discretionary anyway.
Right, okay. That was my assessment. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2937. Why don't you stay there, Mr. Romain? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2937. The chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Sarah Shield, would you like to carry the bill?
After that note I sent you?
Yeah.
I'll carry it.
I'm not going to even read the note. All right, we're going to open public hearing on House Bill 2699. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
2669.
Yeah, what did I...
2699, you said.
All right, 2669.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, House Bill 2669A allows sellers of certain home service agreements to meet financial stability requirements by filing a surety bond of $25,000.
Mr. Romaine, take it away. Tell us why we need this bill.
This is very important, life or death.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association in support of House Bill 2669. First of all, I want to praise the state agency, which is something you usually don't see, but the Department of Consumer and Business Services has been absolutely wonderful to deal with. We presented a problem to them, and together we worked out something that actually works to benefit everybody in the state. Currently, under state law, for service contracts, to have service contracts, which basically are contracts on heating and cooling systems, things like that, where you could call somebody, you enter into a contract, and if your heater breaks down at 12 o'clock at night on December 23rd, they will come out and fix it, those kind of contracts. The only people who could enter into those contracts were either what we called the Sears exemption, which were the $10 million companies, or the Son of Sears, which are the subsidiaries of the $10 million companies. Or the third was somebody who posted a reimbursement insurance policy, which was very expensive. So what you had were people who were not either getting covered or weren't entering into these kind of contracts. What this does is create another way to actually have a contract like this, and the contractor would have to post a surety bond with the department. It specifies the terms and conditions. It benefits the consumer because these contracts are quite useful. It benefits the industry. There's a lot of consumer protection. There was absolutely no objection to the bill in the House. It passed unanimously. I would urge your support and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Looks like you wowed him.
Unbelievable. Either that or they just want to hear me talk anymore.
It's like some members got up and ran out.
All right. No questions for Mr. Romaine? Okay. I'm closed public hearing. Open work session on House Bill 2669. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, ordered. Sarah Ferriello, would you like to carry?
Happy to do so.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2513. Ms. Harris is away. Oh, hello, Mr. Schaffler. Nice of you to arrive. What would you do? Did you like to testify on the AGC bill? Okay, all right. Mr. Ashkin, why don't you come up and tell us about this bill that's in front of us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Scott Ashkin with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance, a nonprofit corporation composed of relatively large farms and general agricultural operations with a number of employees. The purpose and intent of this measure is to try to solve a problem before it gets too great. It's an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure kind of a bill. There has been a growing problem with the theft of nursery stocks, nursery stock, especially in the Tri-County area where you have suburban areas sprawling out onto farmland. And people discovering that that the cost of nursery stock for landscaping their homes is fairly great in some instances. There has been a growing market for stolen nursery stock. Our bill the meat of which is the underlined section in the second paragraph of my written testimony, would simply codify a practice which wholesale nurseries already employ, which is, wholesale nurseries always accompany any shipment of their nursery stock either with an invoice or a bill of lading, and sometimes both. The invoice includes the location from which the nursery stock was shipped, in other words, the owner of the nursery stock. It includes the location to which the nursery stock is being shipped, or the destination, and it includes, of course, an inventory of the nursery stock so that there's a receipt for that nursery stock that's in the possession of the carrier. Our bill simply requires this practice of including a shipping invoice and or a bill of lading with every shipment of nursery stock to create a paper trail which gives the sheriff or other law enforcement officer probable cause to stop a shipment of nursery stock. That's all the bill does. We've interviewed a number of nurseries, and they said, yeah, it just codifies what we do already. It makes that requirement a condition of their nursery license. And that's what the bill does, Madam Chair. We hope you can support it.
Thank you, Mr. Ashcombe. Well, that certainly answers my question about why we were adding additional regulations on one of Oregon's growing industries. Questions for Mr. Ashcombe. Senator Ringo.
Is there a minimum amount of a minimum shipment size that this could apply to? I don't see that it does.
Madam Chair, no, there's no minimum shipment size.
So if somebody's... Let's say you've got a nursery and they're shipping 5 Arbivita over to, really as part of a landscaping operation. Are they going to need to have a bill of lading for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, no, there is a section in the bill that exempts shipments between different properties in the ownership of a single nursery or farm from these provisions. And so a nursery that is shipping nursery stock to another farm, another part of their farm unit, a parcel which may or may not be contiguous to the home farm, they would be exempt from the provisions of this bill.
But if they're delivering a small amount of nursery stock, say to somebody's home, as part of a landscaping operation, are they going to need to have a bill of lading?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, no. Under the provisions of this bill, the requirement only applies to commercial shipments of nursery stock or nursery stock which is shipped for the purpose of being sold.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions? Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ashcombe, the prepared testimony on the bill indicates that there's, or at least the measure summary indicates there are now nursery stock auctions. Can you touch on that a moment, please?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, yes, this is quite fascinating. Our bill here is patterned on the Department of Agriculture's system for regulating shipments of livestock. In the process of our visiting with ODA officials, the livestock manager of ODA described the Woodburn livestock auction, which had just sold livestock like all livestock auctions in the past have operated. But over about the last decade, a relatively small section of that auction has grown into a relatively large section of the auction, which auctions off nursery stock. And this is a growing part of the livestock auctions business out there in Woodburn right now. Under the provisions of our bill, of course, the sheriff now would have probable cause to ask all of the carriers, all of the drivers of those trucks, to see their invoice. And so one of the objective of our bill here is to perhaps forestall the growth of these markets up front and prevent the markets from developing in the first place.
Thanks. Anybody else? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2513. Open the work session. Chair would move the A engrossed version to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. Senator Ringo, you want to carry?
I'd love to.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. I would like, let's see. Chair would move to suspend the rules and reconsider the vote by which the committee passed House Bill 3465 out of committee. It passed out with a due pass recommendation. The reason why I'm asking this to come back before the committee is there is a minor technical amendment that we, yours truly, forgot to add on to the bill. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing, seeing none, the bill is now before us. The chair would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3456. 3465. Move the dash one amendments. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Could you just give 10 seconds of what these technical amendments do?
Sure. Go ahead. Ms. Harris.
For the record, the purpose of the amendment was to avoid a conflict with another bill pending in one of the two chambers. It was something that LCD drafted up when we discovered the conflict.
Okay. I'm with you. Good.
I want to clarify for the record that my inclination to mix up the numbers was not entirely crazy. Senator Farrelly has been sharing me his copy of the bill he's been looking at, and he was looking at House Bill 3456. So
this is an indicator of why we can't come to agreement on the budget.
This is correct, Senator Farrelly. It is totally a numbers thing. Okay, any further discussion on the dash one amendments?
Which one?
Any objection? Senator Atkinson, do you wish to vote on the dash one amendments to House Bill 3465?
Oh.
Do you wish to vote? Okay. Any objection? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move House Bill 3465 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Ms. Harris, who do you have as a carrier? Did I appoint a carrier before?
I can find that out.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Madam Chair, can I vote on the one I just ran down for?
House Bill 2513.
Yes.
I have no objections.
Madam Chair, is this...
Senator Farrelly.
That's all right.
Okay.
Can we suspend the rules and reopen?
Yeah, I'm happy. Okay, all right.
Madam
okay.
Chair, move that we suspend the rules in order to reconsider the vote.
Vote by which
we...
Pass.
It takes too many words.
House Bill 2513.
2513.
It will not change the outcome.
Will not.
Nor will it delay sine die.
And neither will happen.
objection.
So ordered. House Bill 2513 is in front of us. Aye. Senator Atkinson, how do you vote?
Aye.
Great. All right. Anything else before us today? We're going to be back in at 3 o'clock. I'm very sorry. This will be sort of the order of business for the next week. And then hopefully Senator Ringo will be done with Judiciary and we can just meet all day, all the time.
Madam Chair?
Senator Atkinson.
Is Senator Ringo the reason why we can't meet at 1?
That's correct.
Well, why don't we just pass an administrative rule by membership of the committee to change his entire life?
Senator Atkinson.
I could use that for a lot of reasons.
I've tried to do that. The Senate President will not let me.
Let's send it.
There were two bills on the schedule today, House Bill 2077 and House Bill 3206. I would like to bring those back on Thursday. We are on a 24-hour notice, but I just signifying my intent to folks in the committee. Anything else to come before? Thank you. We're adjourned.